This is the Wisdom Podcast.
Welcome to the Wisdom Podcast. I'm Daniel Aiken, and for this episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Malcolm Smith for a second time on the Wisdom Podcast. Malcolm is a well-respected translator in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition and longtime practitioner of Dzogchen. In this rich conversation, Malcolm and I discuss the 17 Tantras of the Great Perfection. Malcolm shares a fascinating history of these teachings and reads from his recent translation of two of its central texts, the Self-Arisen Vidya Tantra, Rigpa Rangsha, and the Self-Liberated Vidya Tantra, Rigpa Rangdro. Malcolm also talks about the notion of attachment without clinging in the Dzogchen view, the necessary distinctions between Trekcher and Togo practice, and why the language of Pramana is important on the Dzogchen path. Malcolm also addresses how the Dzogchen view rejects non-dualism and clarifies a popular misunderstanding of the notion of the term basis. If you're interested in hearing more from Malcolm Smith, check out our first podcast interview with him, where he shares stories from his own spiritual journey, as well as insights from his translation of Buddhahood in This Life, a core Dzogchen text. I hope you enjoyed the conversation.
When we talk about the 17 Tantras, it's important to understand that the 17 Tantras are, for the most part, each themselves self-sufficient texts, because they all explain the main point of Dzogchen teachings. But they're also interrelated texts, and with the exception of the Dzogpa Rangjung, which mostly is about ancillary rituals, for example, guiding the dead through the bardo and dealing with nagas and this sort of thing. The Dzogpa Rangjung Tantra is not really a Dzogchen Tantra in the sense that you're going to read about the main practices of Dzogchen in this text.
It's an activities manual.
It's mostly an activities manual. Yeah. Things that lamas need to do when they're Dzogchen practitioners. So in any event, texts like the Rigpa Rangshar and the Rigpa Rangdrol, Longchenpa says quite clearly in the Druptop Zud, he says, and this again is based on a statement in the Mutig Trengwa, the String of Pearls Tantra, that if you have an understanding of the Rigpa Rangshar, the Rigpa Rangdrol, and the Yige Mepa, the Tantra without syllables, then that person will have a general understanding of the entire structure of Dzogchen teachings.
Yeah, and you have the quote to start your introduction. It says, one will have command over the general meaning of the Tantras like a king who has command over his subjects.
Exactly.
So if you have these three, if one knows, I guess, not just have them, so you got to read them once you buy them.
Yeah, you have to know them, right? You can't just leave them on your shrine.
If one knows the self-arisen vidya, the self-liberated vidya, and tantra without syllables, these three tantras, that you have this sort of overview and understanding of all, why is that?
Well, the reason is this. Number one, the Rigpa Rangshar starts out, and it presents, when we talk, okay, so first of all, the Rigpa Rangshar starts, if you look in the Vima Nintig, and there's a text, I can't remember the title of it off the top of my head, but it's
And I'm going to jump in every now and again and say what Malcolm's talking about is the Self-Arisen Vidya Tantra, Rigpa Rangshar, which is volume one of this new box set we're putting out.
Yes, that's right. So in any case, so in there, when the Rigpa Rangshar is discussed, and I actually bring this up in the introduction, the Rigpa Rangshar is principally considered to be the tantra that teaches view, conduct, and meditation. So this is the general outline of teachings that you find in Nyingma in general, and you find in overall in Tibetan Buddhism. Whenever you go to any teaching with any teacher anywhere, you're always going to find them teaching first the view, then the meditation, then the conduct, and then the result. So the Rigpa Rangshar starts with this. But what it does do something which is rather interesting is that the Vajrapani in the beginning of the text, he says, Buddha. And by the way, I refer to, although the name of the Buddha in this particular, who taught this particular tantra is Pawushono Tubden, he's considered to be a Nirmanakaya emanation of Sambhogakaya Vajradhara. And so therefore it means that as a person, he's identical with Shakyamuni Buddha. So in my introduction, I consistently, rather than the name Pawushono Tubden, which is clumsy and not, well, just it's harder to type, frankly, than Buddha. So anyway, I just simply refer to Pao Shono Tubden in this text as the Buddha, because he is the Buddha. So when mm-hmm. we're talking about, when you see in my introduction, discussions about the Buddha saying this, the Buddha saying that, some people may go, oh, well, but this isn't taught by Shakyamuni Buddha, but actually it is taught by Shakyamuni Buddha mm-hmm. because these 12 primordial teachers prior to Garab Dorje are special teachers of Dzogchen teachings, which I do go into a little bit in the text. The reason why they're special is because they have 36 deeds of body, speech, and mind, meaning that they all have 100, that these 12 Buddhas, unlike other Buddhas who only have 12 deeds, these 12 particular Buddhas responsible for Dzogchen teachings have a total of 108 qualities of body, speech, mind qualities, and activity, etc.
So where are these in? So Garab Dorje, are these after Garab Dorje?
These are before Garab Dorje.
So Vajrasattva, Garab Dorje got the teachings from Vajrasattva.
You have to understand that Garab Dorje, they present it in this way.
Yeah.
But in reality, since the three kayas are inseparable, and since Garab Dorje is an Nirmanakaya, when we hear about Garab Dorje, you know, appearing in front of, you know, Vajrasattva appearing in front of Garab Dorje and giving him teachings, it's not really like that. The reality of it is that Vajrasattva is the Sambhogakaya of Garab Dorje, just as Samantabhadra is the Dharmakaya of Garab Dorje, because Garab Dorje is a pure Nirmanakaya. Yeah. So this is another thing we have to understand in Dzogchen teachings. Actually, in Dzogchen teachings, it's very clearly defined what tulkus are. And so it says there's basically three kinds of tulkus. There are tulkus who are pure tulkus, who are Nirmanakayas like Shakyamuni Buddha, etc., Garab Dorje, Padmasambhava, etc. These are beings who achieved Buddhahood, you know, countless eons ago. And in the case of Shakyamuni Buddha, Garab Dorje, and so on, their story, very simply put, is that there was a man who, in the previous Mahakalpa to this one, Mahakalpa is made up of 64 minor kalpas, just so you know, which is a really long time. There was a man who studied in three lifetimes under successive Buddhas, achieved complete Buddhahood, and during and after the dark eon, which separated that previous Mahakalpa from this Mahakalpa, out of his realization experience, there emerged the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, and then the Nirmanakaya, which the first being is Nangwadampa, and then 12 more teachers who are responsible for promulgating Dzogchen teachings in this particular world system. Okay, that is one kind of Nirmanakaya. The second kind of Nirmanakaya is a person who's been blessed by a teacher. And in this case, what's really meant is someone who's achieved realization through Dzogpa Chenpo teachings. So there is a rather controversial doctrine in Dzogchen teachings that a realized master can, just merely by putting his rikpa, his knowledge in people, can liberate up to 3,000 other people. And this shouldn't sound very strange. For example, the Sakyapas have this concept where you achieve Buddhahood in a sombu. And a sombu means that the disciple, the guru, and their consort, as well as two of their disciples, and it can be many more, also necessarily, this is part of Vajrayana doctrine, necessarily when somebody achieves Buddhahood, according to the Lamdre system, there's a minimum of five people who achieve Buddhahood at the same time. So this is quite different than the Sutrayana idea of Buddhahood, where everyone just achieves Buddhahood, you know, one at a time as a one-off. In Vajrayana, we have the concept of people achieving Buddhahood en masse.
With attributes. And
yes, like really achieving Buddhahood. So like if I reach the sort of ultimate experience of Dzogchen teachings and achieve, you know, rainbow body, then automatically 3,000 of my disciples should achieve Buddhahood along with me. This is the idea. It's probably not going to happen because I'm a terrible practitioner, but here's hoping. Anyway, this idea is very revolutionary from a Sutrayana point of view. You never find anything like this in Sutra. Anyway, this is a digression.
I'm going to jump in. Yeah. Oh, so you've done two tulkus, Nirmanakayas.
Right, I'm getting to the third one. So these are reverse progression tulkus who are called blessed tulkus. Yeah. They're basically people who've encountered realized masters, and then they get recognized as being sort of special people in their lives. Then there's what we call forward progression impure tulkus. And as you can imagine, these are just all sentient beings.
Yeah, because they are
So basically, we're all tolkus.
Yeah, that's true.
So we're all nirmanakayas.
True. Yeah, we're all yangsis, you know.
We're all yangsis. We're all nirmanakayas.
But then using the word nirmanakaya is difficult.
Not at all.
I know Trukul is a translation of nirmanakaya, but attesting in Sanskrit nirmanakaya.
No, they're nirmanas because they were born. That's why in Vajrayana we have a nirmana chakra.
Yeah, but is this attested in Sanskrit text? Is what I'm saying.
Well, it depends on who you believe.
Yeah.
It depends on whether you believe the. It depends. I mean, these things are attested to in. Certainly attested to in Dzogchen scriptures, which are reputed to be translations of Sanskrit texts.
Fair enough.
Of course, one of the things is that this is one kind of thing about the tradition that is a little unfortunate, is that it appears that after the time of Longchenpa, that these commentaries on the 17 tantras went out of circulation. I often think that they went out of circulation because Longchenpa did such an excellent job of summarizing them that no one studied them anymore. I know for a fact that Longchenpa had them in front of him because, he mentions all of their titles. Number two, titles that Longchenpa mentions are mentioned in Buddhahood. Number three, I have clear evidence and can show where Longchenpa borrowed entire portions of the commentary, for example, on the Dratalgyur Tantra, where he borrowed entire portions of it and just incorporated it in the Tekchok Zod without attribution, you know, literally word for word. Mm-hmm. So we know that large portions of the Tekchok Zod in particular, he just incorporated parts of these commentaries from the 17
Excuse
tantras.
Excuse my ignorance. Dratalgyur is one of the 17 tantras?
Yes. Dratalgyur is considered... This is another point about we're going to get to about the Yigimepa.
Yeah.
The Dratalgyur is considered to be the root tantra of Dzogchen teachings because it was the very first tantra taught in this Mahakalpa during the first eon by the teacher Nangwa Dampa. Mm-hmm. So at that point, everybody took apparitional birth, and Nangwa Dampa manifested, and he taught the Dratalgyur as well as the other 17 tantras. The second tantra that he taught after the Dratalgyur was actually the Yigimepa.
Okay.
But I'll return to that in a minute. So there's a beautiful image in the Dratalgyur where it talks about this sort of like 6.4 million stars in the sky, but 17 are the brightest. And this is a sort of a prodomal omen of the revelation of the 17 tantras. I wanted to work it into the book there, but, you know, then the book would have been like, you know, it would have been three volumes with like a volume of me waffling on about things I thought was
That's
awesome.
That's why I got the video.
In any case, you know, there's this beautiful origin story of the 17 tantras in the Dratalgyur, which also contains a lineage history of masters all the way up to a prediction history all the way up to... by name, all the way up to Chetsun Sengi Wangchuk, and then the next two masters don't have explicit names, but they're considered to be Chagum Nakpo. Shangtung Tashi Dorje, who is the Tertön of the Vima Nintig, and then Kepa Nibum, actually, who is considered to be an emanation of Vajrapani. However, so this is one way of talking about the 17 tantras and their relationships. The idea is that the Dratalgyur is the root tantra, and the other tantras are all various kinds of commentary tantras. When it comes to subject matter, however, there's a different way of counting the root tantras of the 17 tantras, and that would be the Yigimepa and the Dzogpa Rangjung tantra, since it's the empowerment tantra. So the Yigimepa, and we translate it as tantra without syllables, which I know is a kind of a clumsy translation, but it's necessary for a reason. This whole idea of syllables is connected to tantric anatomy and the idea that our body is, apart from its external manifestation, that our channels form what are called nadi granthas in Sanskrit, which look like syllables. And so and then even beyond that, inside of the nadis, you have like the outer nadi, then inside of the nadi you have syllables, then inside of that you have bindus, and finally you have vayus, or the airs. And so basically what the the real point of, so that in the commentary to the Yige Mepa, it goes into all of this anatomy, actually discusses this very explicitly. There's two points that the Yige Mepa has. One point is that language does not approach the meaning of Dzogchen, that you cannot approach the meaning of Dzogchen through language at all. The second thing that the Yige Mepa does is that it actually relates the experience of Dzogchen teachings to our physical anatomy. It's a very important point. To get back to the sort of Rick Barangshar and what its role here is, having sort of outlined the view and the meditation and the conduct, which of course it emphasizes first. It emphasizes conduct first because it basically points out that you can't have a properly established view in meditation unless you have a proper conduct. And so what is the proper conduct of a Dzogchen practitioner? According to the Rick Barangshar, the proper conduct of a Dzogchen practitioner is attachment which is free of clinging. And this is actually this refers really to allowing your sense organs to make contact with all objects without clinging to them. Mm-hmm. So you have attachment without clinging. And this is a very common...
What's the Tibetan?
It's a chocolate... It's a chocolate shenba mepa.
So
it's literally attachment with... Because it goes through and says, you know, it goes through all of the conduct of like shravakas and bodhisattvas and tantric practitioners, which are all basically, you know, trying to deal with attachment in various different kinds of way. So like for mantra practitioners are trying to transform attachment, shravakas and bodhisattvas are kind of a little terrified of clinging and attachment. So here, what the text is saying, it's actually there. We can find it if we want to look it up.
It's okay. I was interested in the word for the contact.
Yeah, well, it's basically, the word is shempa. It's chakpa and shempa. So yeah. Here it's saying you have attachment which is lacks clinging. And that just means that you allow your sense organs to make contact with their objects. Actually, that's all it really means. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of like, you can see in a monastic community, this is kind of like racy language.
Yeah, because monastic, you would normally say rakpa, right? Contact without attachment.
Yeah, but here you actually have to have like attachment.
A contact without clinging. But yes. Here we want to say attachment without clinging.
Yeah, but here means that you're actually like, you're really allowing your sense organs to be attached to phenomena.
Yeah.
It has a special to do with the Togol teachings in general, but that we can't really discuss too openly. But people who understand, and then they will get the point. But in just even a very simple way, we very often in Dzogchen teachings talk about resting in an equipoise, leaving the six sense gates free. Mm. It's also talking about that if your eye gets attracted to, you know, a pretty bird that goes and sits on a tree, this is not a problem.
No.
There's only a problem if there's clinging. And even Naropa says, even Naropa says, he says that contact isn't the problem, clinging is the problem.
Yeah.
Attachment isn't the problem, clinging is the problem.
Yeah.
You know, this is the whole basis of, you know, all this sort of erotic yogas is the idea that, you know, attachment isn't the problem, it's clinging that's the problem. Of course, this gets sort of abused, particularly these days, but nevertheless, the fundamental idea behind it is sound and justifiable in Dharma. But it's not the same type of, you know, it's not like this Mahayana idea where, you know, there's one, Sonam Semo in his Gyude Chinam, he talks about this example that in Vajrayana, we don't give up sense objects. We use sense objects for our own pleasure, rather than in Mahayana, where we may engage in what appears to be the consumption of sense objects, but only if it's part of the four means of conversion.
Yeah.
And there's an example of a famous bodhisattva who had a party with 64,000 women, but of course it's maintained that, you know, while he was having this massive party with all these women, he himself was not involved on any level of attachment whatsoever. But we know that in Vajrayana, this is not the correct way. You are supposed to enjoy sense objects for yourself. But of course, in Vajrayana, unlike Dzogchen, then we try to transform them into something, you know, mm-hmm. in order to turn everything into an island of gold, right? Mm-hmm. Dzogchen uses the same metaphor, but it differently.
How so?
Well, the difference is in Vajrayana, the idea is that through the exercise of creation stage, for example, you're trying to turn your sensory experience into gold. Mm-hmm. Like Dajin Ajahn Rinpoche uses the example of like gold transformation elixir used to transform base metal. In Dzogchen, you're working from the point of view of the primordial purity of all phenomenon, understanding that all phenomenon have already been gold from the very beginning without changing anything. So it's just a different approach. Well, there are different kinds of view, and it's important to understand them, which is why, of course, one of the chapters of the Rig Barangshar goes through the 360 different worldly views, and then it goes through the nine yanas. But prior to that, what it does is, having discussed and talked about like the sort of view, conduct view, meditation result, it talks about the three kayas, and then it goes into talking about in the need for empowerment, the need to pick a qualified guru, the need for qualified gurus to pick qualified students. And then it goes into a very interesting section where it starts talking about the five kayas and the five pristine consciousnesses or yeshes, the five lights, the five elements, the five vayus, the five prajnas. And it really, there's a statement somewhere in one of the commentaries. It says, everything in Dzogchen is done in fives. Everything is five. You got five skandhas, you know, because, you know, and so so what the Rig Barangshar does is it really lays out, if you can see the text for a second, it really lays out very systematically how we should understand the basis.
Yeah.
So none of these things, such as the five kayas, pristine consciousnesses, 25 pristine consciousness, five lights, five outer elements, inner elements, etc. The five, you know, the prana, the wisdoms, blah 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 blah. None of this actually, all of this only unfolds because of delusion. Mm-hmm. This is the one thing that people need to understand. Very importantly, all of this sort of emanational stuff is there so that when we're doing the primary practice of Dzogchen. Here's another point. These days, most people think that Tekchot is the main practice of Dzogchen, and many people present Tekchot as being the main practice of Dzogchen. For example, in Kenpo Jigme Punsok's Buddhahood in the Palm of Your Hand, he calls Tekchot the main practice, and he calls Togol the sort of subsequent practice. Yep. This has to do with a sort of skepticism that has emerged within the Nyingma school, and it's not a skepticism of Westerners, it's a skepticism of Tibetans. That whether or not Tibetans can really take the practice of Dzogchen to its complete end. But when you look at the early texts of Dzogchen teachings, you see that Tekchot is always connected with the basis, and Togol is actually the path. For example, if you read in Buddhahood, it will clearly makes this distinction. So the idea is that people who are Tekchot practitioners are really, really smart people who are lazy, who wake up immediately from having received, you know, so it's a little bit of explanation of Dzogchen. They're Chikcharwas, like Saraha. They wake up right away. And then sort of plotting people like myself all have to do Togol practice, which involves a lot of sitting and, you know, to having good training in shamatha is necessary for this. The reason why we have all of this discussion of the five this's and the five that's and the five other things is because it's talking about everything going from the most subtle level of the basis, which is the three kayas of the basis, Kadak, Lundup, and Tuje, or, you know, it's more simply put, emptiness, which is Kadak, which is Dharmakaya, clarity, which is Lundup, which is the nature, which is Sambhogakaya, and then compassion, which is the inseparability of clarity and emptiness, and this is the mnemonic kaya. This is all the three kayas of the basis, but this doesn't necessarily mean that we realize them. This is another point that people don't understand, is that the word basis in Tibetan doesn't really refer to a foundation that is like overarching or universal.
Yeah.
In fact, Dzogchen teachings reject non-dualism. This is one point that many people don't really understand. They don't reject non-dual experience, but they reject non-dualism as being an ontological thing, that there is some ontological non-dual basis out of which everything comes, like a Gnostic pleroma, for example. This is rejected. The point, the what the basis really refers to, and you have to understand it in terms of the Zhi Lam Dre, or as Kense Wangpo puts it, Shtan Marga Pala. So the Shtan, or the Zhi, the basis, refers to something that we haven't realized yet. Otherwise, there's no reason to call it a basis. Yeah. So the basis is what we don't know, is what we haven't realized. Now, this doesn't mean that in Dzogchen teachings we're realizing anything other than the basis. We aren't. The basis is what we haven't realized. The path is the techniques for realizing what we haven't realized. And the result is the result of that path. So here, when we talk about the five kayas and pristine consciousnesses and so on and so forth, also Dzogchen divide has two different sets of pristine consciousnesses, or yeshe. There's the three pristine consciousnesses of the basis called essence, nature, and compassion, ngo, rangjing, and tuje. Yeah. Then there are the five relative pristine consciousnesses, such as the pristine consciousness, the mirror-like pristine consciousness, the individually discerning pristine consciousness, the pristine consciousness of uniformity, the pristine consciousness of successful activity, and the pristine consciousness of the Dharmadhatu. These five are relative, and these five are what produce the five lights, because at this point, the mind, which is really what the basis refers to, is the nature of our mind that we haven't realized. Because there's movement within our consciousness, this creates patterning. This patterning manifests as five colors, which are the sort of evidence of the five light of the five pristine consciousnesses, and the five Buddha families, which is what the five kayas really refers to. When we talk about five, when we talk about kayas and wisdoms in Anuyoga, what we're talking about there, when we talk about so just back up for a second. In Anuyoga, when we talk about ying and yeshe, we talk about the dhatu and jnana. There, we're really talking about a realized consciousness within a field, within an empty field. But when we talk about Ying and Rik and Dzogchen, there we're talking about something else completely different. And the two ideas and concepts are related to each other. But in the case of Dzogchen teachings, what we're really talking about is being completely integrated within the experiential and visionary practice, which Dzogchen is so famous for. Which is connected to the creation stage and the completion stage, but it's doing the same thing differently. So the point I'm making here is the reason why we have this unfolding of five things is because when we do the practice of Dzogchen, we're actually reversing that process of emanation.
And that's a Togol practice.
That's what Togol practice is
for.
That's
why it's called a Dzogchen rather than Trekcher, is your point, right?
That's why this Togol is considered to be, at least in the earlier text, to be the main path of Dzogchen teachings. However, does this mean that people should practice Tekcho right away? No. Togol. No, they shouldn't. And there's a very good reason for this. Because you're in when we're practicing creation completion stage, we generate a deity, we sort of spend some time developing divine pride, remembering its purities, and so on and so forth. And then we practice completion stage in order to eradicate traces of clinging to that pure vision that we have cultivated. One thing we have to understand is that in Tekcho teachings, there's no practice of pure vision whatsoever. While you are, of course, resting in the knowledge that all phenomena are primordially pure from the very beginning, in reality, you're not ever working with pure vision when you're doing texture teachings.
Meaning that you're not engaging imagination to create something? Is that what you mean by pure vision?
Well, okay, that's one thing. You're never engaging in any imagination to generate a pure vision.
Yep.
However, you'll notice that almost everybody who's practicing Tekchode is practicing the creation stage as the creation stage and practicing tekshod as the completion stage. Because there isn't actually any difference between tekshod. There is no difference between the completion stage, the knowledge of the completion stage practiced in, say, Lamdre or the six yogas of Naropa or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's no difference between that knowledge of the completion stage and that equipoise that you cultivate in the completion stage and tekshod.
Yeah.
They're the same thing. Jaman Kenshi Chogyi Lodo's main Sakya disciple, Lothair Wangpo, wrote a beautiful treatise on Mahamudra. And in there, he says that the real point of these systems, Korda Yerme, Kagyu Mahamudra, the Dzogchen Tekshod, etc., is to remain in Tamal Gishepa, ordinary mind, which he defines as being a moment of unfabricated consciousness. It's a Machupa Sheba Ke Chikma. And he says being in that is the real view that we're cultivating. So that when we talk about the view in Vajrayana, and this is actually made very clear, for example, in Lamdre. When you take Lamdre, there's this whole system of meditations called practicing the view of the inseparability of samsara and nirvana. And this view can only be practiced on the basis of having received the empowerments. Mm-hmm. And then you practice this view, and it's rather elaborate, and people who, you know, people can read Lamdre books and find out what I'm talking about. But the main point is here is that you're supposed to practice the view for quite a long time, even before you begin to engage really in creation stage practices.
Yeah.
Why? Because the view is not meditation, but the view is not meditation in the sense that in Lamdre, the view is meditating on the creation, the completion stages. But that view has to be informed by the experience of the example pristine consciousness, which is generated at the time of empowerment. Likewise, in Dzogchen teachings, there's also empowerments. There's also direct introduction. And at that time, an example pristine consciousness is generated, and the student is supposed to cultivate that example pristine consciousness for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So the point here is that before engaging in the meditation of Dzogchen...
So that's your tekshod practice, right?
You have to do tekshod practice. Yeah. And because you need to be also accumulating, you need to be gathering the two accumulations and so on and so forth. Therefore, in the system of Nyingma in general, people are always practicing some kind of creation stage practice and then concluding that creation stage practice or guru yoga, it doesn't matter which, with tekshod as the completion stage. So if you're practicing nundro, like Lunchen Nintig Nundro, then for example, after receiving the four empowerments, you're supposed to practice tekshod there. If you, for example, in Dujum Rinpoche's tradition, in the Dujum Terasar tradition, at the end of Dujum Rinpoche's Nundro called the Khandra Nintig, it very clearly states there that this practice has all of the features of creation and completion. So you don't need to do any other practice than this Padmasambhava Guru Yoga, you know, which has all, you know, like refuge and Vajrasattva and so on. And that's sufficient. You don't need to do any other practices other than that. And then, of course, in that same volume, you then have the practice on integrating the three spaces. And then there's a short text written by Dujum Lingpo, which covers Rushen and Tekshod and Togol. And so this is really, you know, this is kind of the sort of like the quick path of Dzogchen and Dujum Terasar. You know, there's many other practices you can do. Dujum Terasar Vajrakalaya has all, you know, complete everything that you need to practice Dzogchen. In fact, one of Dujum Rinpoche's main students in Tibet, a guy named Kempo Achuk, not Kempo Achu, the guy who passed recently, but this guy passed like 1998 or something. He achieved rainbow body through practicing Dujum Lingpa's system, Vajrakalaya. So it's not to say this is the only system within Dujum Terasar. Anyway, the main point I'm making here is that for successful Vajrayana practice, we need to cultivate the view for a very long time until we're very stable in it. And then if we are very stable in it, then our meditation becomes very stable. And so there's, in this sense, there's really no difference between any of these systems. By practicing the view and becoming very stable in it, then our meditation becomes very stable.
So what you're basically saying is, of course, Togo is core to Dzogchen practice because of the reversal of the original process that entered
process of delusion.
Which is equivalent to samsara. So
it is samsara.
And then, but what you're saying in the same breath is that trekcha is important because what in all systems of Vajrayana, can we say that? In all systems of Vajrayana, you must stabilize the example pristine consciousness, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
And so there's a practice of that, and that's almost like a foundation practice. And then...
That's why they say tekchot is the basis.
Tekchot is the basis. That's why tekchot is the basis. And then we also, in any practice, there's also this worry about... not having traces left over, right? And so mm-hmm. you complete, like you do the completion stage practice, right?
Correct.
So that's pretty much what you've been saying in a nutshell. Did I get it?
Well, basically, this is why very often people say that Togol is like the completion stage.
Mm-hmm.
Because in fact, it is what should remove all traces of karma and so on and so forth, karma and affliction, and their traces from your continuum so that you can achieve. Because the reality of it is that, and I think that, personally think that Dzogchen explains this more clearly than other systems, is that everything that we experience in our life, we've concretized it as the five. Actually, this question comes up in the Khandra Nintig. Padmasambhava has asked the question about the Mishik Tigle. The Anahata Bindu, which is in Dzogchen teaching, is called the causal Tigle, the Gyui Tigle.
It's called the causal Tigle.
Yes, yeah. It's called the Gyui Tigle, which means material also, because in Tibetan the word Gyu can mean either cause or material. So like we say the glass is the Gyu that the tabletop is made from.
Rather than like indestructible or something like that.
Well, here's the point. He also says that this Gyui Tigle is also the Rigpa, it's also the Bindu of Rigpa in the middle of the heart, which is unconditioned, uncompounded.
Good.
So he says that this Tigle of Rigpa and the Gyui Tigle are actually the same thing. And so then the objection comes, it's like, well, how can that be possible? Yep. Because you just said... Right, because if you understand Dzogchen anatomy, this is really important. You just said that this Tigle of Rigpa is uncompounded, and you've said that the Gyu Tigle is compounded, and now you've said that they're the same thing. So how does that work?
Yeah.
And Padmasambhava says, you don't have to worry. He said, at the time of delusion, you reified the five lights as the five elements, and since the material Tigle, the causal Tigle, is made of the five elements, it's nothing other than the five lights, which are the cell or the potency, the potential of the pristine consciousness of Rigpa. And so there's no contradiction.
So does it follow that anything, so everything can be looked at in that way, but right?
Yes, however, however, there is a hedge that you have to understand. It's an important hedge. The important hedge is that, and Padmasambhava also makes this very clear, you can't achieve liberation by staring at rocks and trees. Mm-hmm. Even if, in a real sense, our experience of them is concretized in the sort of as the expressions of the five elements because of our delusion, because they're karmic appearances, that won't work. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, you need to have a very important experience called the direct perception of dharmata. And for those people who don't have that experience, I'm not going to explain it, but the main point is that through having, this is one of the reasons where the language of pramana is very important in Dzogchen teachings, is there are sort of an unexamined feature of Dzogchen teachings, the how the language of logic is used, Buddhist logic, Buddhist epistemology, really. Yeah. Forget logic, it's a terrible word for Buddhist epistemology. Yeah, yeah. So pramana, so it uses the term nunsum.
Nunsum gisema.
Yeah, so which in Sanskrit would be something like dharmata pratyaksha. And here, it's really talking about something which you see physically with your eyes. Yeah. And it's also must be understood that it's not a karmic appearance.
Yeah.
And so since rocks and trees are karmic appearances, you can't ever achieve liberation through staring at rocks and trees and rivers and streams. Although you can have some cool experiences because... For example, in various texts, they talk about like if you go and sit in the middle of a stream and listen to its sound for weeks and weeks, eventually you will hear the sound of dakinis and be able to understand all the languages in the six realms. I've never tried it myself. Otherwise, I might be better at language. But anyway, the main point is that here, the idea is that this is an experience, this is a direct perception which arises from a recognition of your own state, which is why it's called dharmata. So another thing we have to be very careful when we're translating Dzogchen text is to distinguish between chunid tongpani, which is dharmata shunyata, and dharmata pratyaksha. These in Dzogchen texts, particularly ones that are a little bit more systematic, these two things, shunyata is dharmata, and then what we're talking about, pratyaksha, when we're talking about like dharmata as being sort of your own state, which you can have this kind of visual experience of, these two things are not the same thing, although they're related to each other. But the term dharmata is very interesting here. Because as you know, having studied Buddhist logic, we have chunit and chu, we have chu, dharmin, chuchen and chunit. Yeah, so you have dharmin and dharmata.
Yeah.
So dharmin is a given thing, like a cup. And its chunit would be like, for example, its hardness and, you know, these kinds of different sort of swalakshanas, if we're going real dharmakirti.
Yeah.
So anyway, so this is important to understand because the Dzogchen masters of old were using this logical language because it was very important for people to understand that also sentient beings have a dharmata. They have two. They have emptiness, which is the general dharmata of all phenomenon, mm-hmm. which is really what you work with more with Tekchod.
Yeah.
Being in a state of recognition.
More like Kadak aspect or not?
Well, Kadak is a term which we find in the Prajnaparamita Sutras. Yeah. If you can run a search on the Prajnaparamita Sutras, and you will find Kane Dakpa being used. It's not it's not some fancy Vajrayana word.
It just means pure.
But the point I'm making about this is that shunyata, it's the same shunyata. I mean, Norbu Rinpoche himself, for example, Chogyal Namkhai Norbu, says very clearly, Tekchod, even and also Togi Organ, you can read in one of his books, I think, As It Is, Volume 1, he says, you know, the practice of everything is Tekchod. All Buddhist schools have Tekchod, he says. So in Dzogchen texts, when we're translating them, we have to be very careful that we understand what the chunit is that we're translating.
Yeah.
Like everything in Tibetan, you have to know the context of it. Otherwise, you can make horrible mistakes.
Yeah.
I've made many of them, but fortunately, I've had lamas to save me. Like, for example, here, if you look on page 267, it says here, the appearance of the pristine, this is talking about the intimate instruction of the five-colored rainbow disappearing into one space. So you could make, if you really didn't understand what's going on here, you could make a big mistake. And the reason why this isn't a very interesting one is because it actually illustrates my point beautifully. Because there's a footnote here, 809, the empty dharmata is apprehended as the child. So this is an example of, you know, how you have to be careful. Particularly, says the appearances of the pristine consciousness of vidya dissolve into the state of empty space. Great non-conceptual vidya dissolves into the utterly pure inexpressible state. The intrinsically pure essence free from grasping dissolves into the great non-conceptual state. The great self purification that never changes dissolves into the state of emptiness that pervades space. The dharmata that is not produced dissolves into the state that neither comes nor goes, etc.
It sounds like on the face of it, like son and mother, sort of clear light stuff.
Yes. But if you actually really pay attention, you have to understand that this is not actually talking about dharmata emptiness.
Mm.
This passage is actually talking about the visions.
Mm. Okay. So it goes through the four.
So the point is that here in the footnote, it's talking about the empty dharmata that's apprehended as the child. But in reality, it's talking about the appearances of pristine consciousness.
Yeah.
This is the dharmata that's being discussed in the dharmata pratyaksha. Those appearances are also empty. But we're not just talking about just emptiness. And if you're not very careful when you're translating these texts, it's very easy to become confused
mm-hmm.
about what the actual meaning of the text is. And so I think I've done okay.
Cool. Why don't you pick a couple of passages of your favorite passages and just riff off it?
Well, one of my favorite passages actually is this one we're talking about. refuting. I actually think one of the most important sections of the book is refuting all opponents. You know, everybody's mm-hmm. made a big deal about how the Bunpos have this great system of Dzogchen debate and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe they do. But here, also in the Rigpa Rangchar, we have this fantastic set of arguments refuting all opponents who mm-hmm. come and say, Dzogchen teachings are just stupid. What are you people talking about? Or this is a problem with your view. So like, for example, he says, alas, alas, gathered retinue, listen, though birth and death do not exist for me, this is the Buddha talking, if nirvana is possible, in order to refute and destroy non-Buddhists with wrong conduct, the chapter of the opponent's argument is explained. Now, we can understand sometimes that when we talk about non-Buddhists, sometimes non-Buddhists are Buddhists. Mm-hmm. So like, for example, there's a passage in the Heivajratantra where the Heivajratantra says, those Buddhist Tirthakas who don't know me will never achieve Buddhahood. So you can understand that sometimes Buddhists are, you know, they're the heretics. Yeah, yeah. Anyway. So this is a really important point. When there is a dispute about the basis, if the company of other disputants asserts natural perfection as the identity of the basis, the question should be asked in this way. How do you assert the production of diversity? So this is just right here. This is clearly referring to the Sankhya idea of, you know, of causes, of effects of self-origination and causes being effects being identical with their cause. Their following reply should be refuted through the reasoning of incompatibility. If contrary to the assertion of the production of diversity, it is asserted that play arises impartially, in that case it will be incompatible in the following way. Because natural perfection is asserted as the identity of the basis, sentient beings cannot be liberated through effort. Now, this is a really interesting point. The reason why this is an interesting point is that always Dzogchen is talking about how it's the effortless liberation, the system of being liberated without effort. But here we have an entire chapter where the Buddha is basically arguing that all of these assertions have the consequence that you can't be liberated through efforts. Mm-hmm. Of course, by the end of the chapter, the Buddha has a very surprising explanation for what liberated through effort means. But the point that he constantly makes is if you assert that the basis is like spontaneously present, and that's all the basis is, then you couldn't really have liberation becomes impossible because cause and effect becomes impossible. So in any case, non-duality. So these days it's very popular to assert that Advaita Vedanta and Papaji and Ramana Maharshi and Muji and Kashmir Trikashaivism, Muktananda and these guys and they're all fine on their own, and Mahamudra and Dzogchen, that these all have the same meaning, and that basically, you know, it's all one mountain, and we're all just climbing up different slopes of this one mountain. This is what some people believe. Of course, there's a whole chapter in here called Dominating the Summits, where it's explained how Dzogchen teachings dominate the summits of all the other different teachings. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Dzogchen point of view is there's lots of mountains, but we're the highest.
Yeah.
You know, that's
a very everyone's view, actually.
Yes, I know. but the rest of them are wrong. And the reason why they're wrong is because either they assert duality or they assert non-duality. Dzogchen asserts neither, actually. And this is an interesting point. But in order to show this, you have to understand how Dzogchen teachings refute non-duality. Mm-hmm. So here it says, the Buddha says, some assert non-duality is pure. These are the rebuttals to that. What is the non-duality that those who assert non-duality mention? And then the opponent comes up. He says, the opponents reply to that. All phenomena are non-dual. Therefore, there can be no duality. Since there are no sentient beings, there are no Buddhas. Therefore, non-duality is freedom from the extremes of dualistic appearances. Now, this sounds pretty reasonable, right? And when I first was translating this, I was like, yeah, it sounds pretty reasonable. Okay, I kind of go along with that. Now then, is this stated for the utterly pure meaning, or is it stated for the objects of deluded appearance? So now the Buddha's mm-hmm. giving two options here. Our reply to that and the explanation of the proofs. That is the case in the utterly pure meaning, but there is a dualistic appearance in the objects of deluded appearances. So this is what
this
the
is
Buddhist...
standard sort of
yeah.
trope, right?
Oh, total standard. But this is what the Buddhist whole argument hinges on. It's like, okay, in the utterly pure meaning, and that's Yandak Dumpa, ultimate truth, true. You know, yeah, we can say there's no duality, but also there's also diverse appearances. So what do you do with those? Mm-hmm. So the opponent says, well, because in reality there's no duality, in reality, duality in appearances is not reasonable. So their whole argument hinges upon confusing the two truths, actually.
Yeah. Say that again, that last line.
Because in reality there is no duality, in reality, duality in appearances is not reasonable.
It's falling into nihilism based on...
Basically, yes. In that case, it is reasonable that all sentient beings will be liberated without the need for effort. Why? Because duality does not exist in the basis. Okay? Reply. Now then, the Buddha's not going to take him up on this quite yet, because he goes, well, how is duality asserted? He asks. When there are no Buddhas and no sentient beings, there's no third or second or third in the basis. Because the potentiality of play arises from that, Buddhas and sentient beings arise as a duality. This is just a flat-out statement that the Buddha makes in response to the position that there's in reality there's no duality. He's saying that it's fine at the point of view where you're having a non-dual experience to say there's no Buddhas or sentient beings, but the minute there's a stirring of consciousness and the appearance of Buddhas and sentient beings arises, then at this point you have duality, and your whole concept that there is in that all phenomena are non-dual dual collapses. Then it continues. The opponent now says to the Buddha, he says, oh, I've got you now, Buddha. He says, now you assert that duality exists in the basis because there's no good or bad in the basis. For what reason it is said to exist as a duality? Because in that case, there cannot be transformation. Why? It is reasonable sentient beings do not attain Buddhahood. For example, even though coal is polished, it will never become white. In the same way, deluded sentient beings will never become Buddhas through practicing meditation. This is the idea, right? Because sentient beings are deluded, the Buddhas are not deluded, you can't change coal by washing it.
Falling into internalism here.
It's here, yes, you can say that. The reply is given, because it exists to, this is such a beautiful answer too, it's so simple. Actually, the same answer is given in Buddhahood. There's a similar argument in there. He said, because it exists to be explained, the result is obtained through explanation. And this is the key point of Dzogchen teachings. Because it exists to be explained, the result is attained through the explanation. This is exactly how Garab Dorje liberated Manjushri Mitra. He didn't give him empowerments. He didn't make him do a whole bunch of stuff. He just explained the meaning of the teachings to Manjushri Mitra. Manjushri Mitra woke up. Mm-hmm. This is the quintessential point of the three words of Garab Dorje, you know, Rangno Tokdu Tre basically means encounter your own state, literally your own face. Very Zen, right? You know, what's your original face? Yeah. That they're always constantly asking this in Zen. I have no idea what they mean, but anyway. But if they said it to me in Tibetan, I might understand. Actually, it's very interesting. You know, they have this whole thing about Bodhidharma facing a wall for nine years. If you look at the translation of that very same passage in the Denghuang material, Nubchen Sangye Yeshe's material, they translate wall as facing reality. Mm. So actually in the Tibetan version of this account, they have Bodhidharma facing reality for 9 years,
if you make that mistake.
What's interesting about that, no, it's not a mistake. See, what's interesting about that is that that term must have been a very colloquial term in the Zen tradition at that time. But when those Zen masters went to Tibet and they translated it into Tibetan for the Tibetans, they went for the meaning rather than for the colloquial term.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you mistake face reality for face the wall,
yes,
you waste a lot of time.
Well, I think it was just, yes, no, I agree. I agree with you. Yes, but it's very interesting. Today you have Zen people who meditate facing walls. Well, let's hope they're facing reality. In any case, if not explained, how can there be liberation? Basically what the Buddha's here is saying, there are no signs in the dharmas of the basis. So there's nothing to perceive there. You couldn't say that there's There is no science there. It's just characteristicless. This is standard Madhyamaka.
Yeah.
There's no grasping to dharmas of the path, and there's no attainment of the dharma of the dharmata of the result. The basis of sentient beings and the basis of Buddhahood are definitely differentiated by a soul difference. For what reason is there a soul difference? Why is it called the soul difference? The basis of Buddhahood is pristine consciousness, and the basis of sentient beinghood is the absence of pristine consciousness. And so then this is one of the most beautiful definitions of yeshe, really, I've ever read. When both the pristine state, ye, and the consciousness of it are combined, it is the sublime transcendent state of the Buddhas. Therefore, what other differences are there? Basically, what the Buddha is saying here is that when somebody explains to you your real state and you recognize that real state, then slowly you can have this experience that we call the transcendent state. So this requires a little bit of explanation. There's a term in Tibetan, which is a very important term, called Gongpa. Most translators up until now have been translating the term intention. Gongpa as intention. And it's an understandable error, but in reality, particularly when you look at the commentaries of the 17 tantras, it's made very clear, and you can also see this in the Siktenzud, and you can see this in Buddhahood. There are three phases of meditational equipoise. The first one is called the Semsins of Devas and Humans, and those are the exercises like visualizing a white awe on your nose and trying to induce shamatha this way. Then the next one is called the Dhyana of the Bodhisattvas. And finally, we have the Gongpa of the Tathagatas, the transcendent state of the Tathagatas, which is in Sanskrit, it's called Samati. And in this particular use, is Abhipraya is one translation of it. Rangjin is another way that Gongpa was translated in the Longde material. So like in Longde, we have a Gongpe Naljor, and the Sanskrit for that is Prakriti Yoga.
Yeah. Rangjin nature.
So Rangjin Naljor.
Yeah, Rangjin.
So, I mean, that's Gongpa Naljor. So Gongpa here is a translation of Prakriti, which means something like original yoga somehow.
Okay.
Anyway, the main point here is that Gongpa refers to the state of a Buddha's equipoise, which is 24/7, 365. And oftentimes, you know, you see Tibetans translate, you know, sort of they want to always interpret and understand Gongpa as an honorific for mind, which is a little true. But if you understand how the term is actually being defined, it's being defined in terms of the fact that a Buddha is never separate from his own state. That also, like in another place, it says in one of the commentaries, actually, I think it's in Buddhahood. It says the or maybe it's in the Gongpa Zangtel, I don't know, I've read way too many books, but it says that the rikpa of sentient beings is fragmented.
Yeah.
Means it's not continuous. But the rikpa, the knowledge of Buddhas, is whole. Yeah. It's absolutely uninterrupted. And this is what Gongpa means. So when we talk about the transcendent state of a Buddha, what we're talking about is being in this kind of state of knowledge, this equipoise of reality all of the time. And so what here the Buddha is saying is that this is realized through the explanation of the nature of reality, and that's it. So in the Buddhahood, it says that it uses, in a similar passage, it said, liberation is just there to be picked like the fruit off of a tree. But if you don't know that there's fruit on the tree, there's nothing you can pick. And this is a very beautiful thing. But of course, it kind of gives, you know, scholars like Sakyapandita panic attacks, because then people are like, you know, ignoring doing their, you know, mantras, and they're not accumulating merit, and they're running around and getting distracted and becoming like Tarpa Nakpo. I mean, you know, sort of black liberation in the Pema Khatang literature. And, you know, we all know what happened to Tarpa Nakpo, right?
So Gongpa, this is normally translated as intention. You're thinking of it in Dzogchen literature as state, right?
Like it's a kind of a state.
Ngangne or something like.
It's a nangwa.
Nangwa.
It's a state. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's basically pretty much your state of realization, which is constant. I mean, sometimes people are struggle with it. Sometimes you see Gongpa translated as realization, which is not wrong, but then
in Dzogchen?
Some Dzogchen translators want to translate as Tokpa, for example. As if it were Tokpa, realization.
Yeah.
I've tried that myself, a primordial realization. I mean, this is not an easy word to translate.
Like continuous realization or something like that.
Something like this.
But state is
but
nice.
But then if you're like, how do you distinguish it from Tokpa then?
Yeah.
It doesn't really. It is talking about a realization. That's true. I mean, this is the point where translation of terms becomes very arbitrary, and at a certain point, you just have to like basically explain, explain stuff to your students, and hope that they get it and that they don't run out and start, you know, street battles with other Buddhists over terms. It could happen. It happened
in
Tibet.
Well, here's the thing: if you
say
like,
in Tibet.
If you say like, this is what I mean, that I'm going to translate it as this, and this is what I mean by that, you fill it out a little bit, and then people have that running knowledge as they read your translation.
Yes, and then when someone who knows better than you comes along in 50 years, and hopefully there will be people who know better than us who come along in 50 years, they'll go, yeah, you know, Smith kind of got it right, but this is a better word.
Yeah, and language changes as well.
And it does, yeah.
So there may be there may be a
new word. So basically, we're looking at what? The self-liberated video 1.0. It's going to be like, it's going to. We're going to have to update it in about 8 months, you know? Yeah. So anyway.
I think we're done, right?
Have I wiped you out?
That was fantastic.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Next on the Wisdom Podcast, I speak with Sharon Salzberg, world-renowned author and meditation teacher, and co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts.
The Buddha taught these life practices and inner practices as well to gladden the mind so that you had a more spacious, open, allowing, warm, loving kind of internal environment with which you could meet the suffering. And so that's things like generosity or morality, which make us happier. So we're more buoyant. We're not going into a complex reflection, for example, feeling horrible about ourselves. You know, we're going with a sense of joy that we've made some good choices, and loving kindness fits in there.